them to her myself. I reckon she was on her way to work. Brought the receipt in, too.
I had no words to answer him with. I could only stare at him.
"Ask the missus," he said. "She's got them, no mistake."
He took a cigarette from the box on the register, put it in his mouth, and lit it with a lighter.
"Yesterday morning?" I asked. "Not evening?"
"Morning for sure. 8 o'clock. Your wife was the first customer of the day. I wouldn't forget something like that. Hey, when your very first customer is a young woman, it puts you in a good mood, know what I mean?"
I was unable to fake a smile for him, and the voice that came from me didn't sound like my own.
"Oh, well, I guess that takes care of that. Sorry, I didn't know she picked them up."
He nodded and glanced at me, crushed out the cigarette from which he had taken no more than 2 or 3 puffs, and went back to his ironing. He seemed to have become interested in me as if he wanted to tell me something, but decided in the end to say nothing, and I, meanwhile, had things I wanted to ask him. How had Kumiko looked when she came for her cleaning? What had she been carrying? But I was confused and very thirsty. What I most wanted was to sit down somewhere and have a cold drink. I felt that was the only way I would ever be able to think about anything again. I went straight from the cleaners to the coffee house a few doors away and ordered a glass of iced tea. The place was cool inside, and I was the only customer. Small wall-mounted speakers were playing an orchestrated version of the Beatles' 8 Days a Week. I thought about the seashore again. I imagined myself barefoot and moving along the beach at the water's edge. The sand was burning hot, and the wind carried the heavy smell of the tide. I inhaled deeply and looked up at the sky. Stretching out my hands, palms upward, I could feel a summer sun burning into them. Soon a cold wave washed over my feet. Whichever way you looked at it, it was odd for Kumiko to have picked things up from the cleaners on her way to work. For one thing, she would have had to squeeze onto a jam-packed commuter train holding freshly pressed clothes on hangers. Then she would have had to do it again on the way home. Not only would they be something extra to carry, but the cleaner's careful work would have been reduced to a mass of wrinkles. As Kumiko was sensitive about such things, I couldn't imagine she would have done something so pointless. All she had to do was stop by on the way home from work. Or, if she was going to be late, she could have asked me to pick them up. There was only one conceivable explanation. She had known she was not coming home. Blouse and skirt in hand, she had gone off somewhere. That way, she would have had at least one change of clothing with her, and anything else she needed she could buy. She had her credit cards and her Cashpoint card and her own bank account. She could go anywhere she wanted. And she was with someone. A man. There was no other reason for her to leave home. This was serious. Kumiko had disappeared, leaving behind all her clothes and shoes. She had always enjoyed buying clothes, to which she devoted considerable care and attention. For her to have left home with little more than the clothes on her back would have required a major act of will, and yet without the slightest hesitation, it seemed to me, she had walked out of the house with nothing more than a blouse and skirt. No, her clothing was probably the last thing on her mind. Leaning back in my chair, half listening to the painful, sanitized background music, I imagined Kumiko boarding a crowded commuter train with her clothes on wire hangers in the cleaner's plastic bags. I recalled the color of the dress she was wearing, the fragrance of the cologne behind her ears, the smooth perfection of her back. I must have been exhausted. If I shut my eyes, I felt I would float off somewhere else. I would end up in a quite different place.
2. No good news in this chapter. I left the coffee house and wandered through the streets. The intense heat of the afternoon began to make me feel sick, even feverish. But the one place I didn't want to go was home. The thought of waiting alone in that silent house for a phone call that would probably never come I found suffocating. All I could think to do was to go and see Mei Kasahara. I went home, climbed over the wall, and made my way down the alley to the back of her house.
Leaning against the fence of the vacant house on the other side of the alley, I stared at the garden with its bird sculpture. May would notice me if I stood here like this. Apart from those few times when she was out working for the wig company, she was always at home, keeping watch over the alley from her room, or while sunbathing in the yard. But I saw no sign of May Kasahara. There was not a cloud in the sky. The summer sunlight was roasting the back of my neck. The heavy smell of grass rose from the ground, invading my lungs. I stared at the bird statue and tried to think about the stories my uncle had recently told me of the fates of those who had lived in this house. But all I could think of was the sea, cold and blue. I took several long, deep breaths. I looked at my watch. I was ready to give up for the day when May Kasahara finally came out. She ambled slowly through her yard to where I stood. She wore denim shorts, a blue aloha shirt, and red thongs. Standing before me, she seemed to be smiling through her sunglasses.
"Hello there, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. Find your cat, Noboru Wataya?"
"Not yet," I said. "What took you so long to come out today?" She thrust her hands into her hip pockets and looked all around, amused.
"Look, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, I may have a lot of free time, but I don't live to stand guard over this alley from morning to night. I have some things to keep me busy. But anyhow, I'm sorry. Were you waiting long?"
"Not so long. I got hot standing out here." May Kasahara stared hard at my face, then wrinkled her eyebrows.
"What's wrong, Mr. Wind-Up Bird? You look terrible, like somebody who's just been dug up out of the ground. Better come over here and rest in the shade for a while."
She took me by the hand and led me into her yard. There she moved a canvas deck chair into the shade of the oak tree and sat me down on it. The thick green branches cast cool shadows that had the fragrance of life.
"Don't worry. There's nobody here, as usual," she said. "You don't have to be the least bit concerned. Take your time. Stop thinking and relax."
"I do have one favor to ask you," I said.
"Try me,"
she said. "I want you to make a call for me." Taking out a notepad and pen, I wrote down the number of Kumiko's office. Then I tore off the page and handed it to her. The little vinyl-covered notepad was warm and damp with sweat. "All I want you to do is call this place and ask if Kumiko Okada is there, and if she's not, ask if she came to work yesterday." May Kasahara took the paper and looked at it with pursed lips. Then she looked at me.
"Fine, I'll take care of it. You must empty your head and get horizontal. You are not allowed to move. I'll be right back."
Once she was gone, I stretched out and closed my eyes as ordered. I was soaked with sweat from head to foot. Trying to think, I felt a throbbing deep in my head, and I seemed to have a lump of string in the pit of my stomach. Every once in a while, a hint of nausea came over me. The neighborhood was absolutely silent. It suddenly occurred to me that I had not heard the wind-up bird for quite some time. When had I last heard it? Probably 4 or 5 days ago, but I wasn't certain. By the time I noticed, its cry had been missing too long to tell. Maybe it was a migratory bird. Come to think of it, we had started hearing it about a month before, and for a time the wind-up bird had continued each day to wind the spring of our little world. That had been the wind-up bird season. After 10 minutes, May Kasahara came back. She handed me a large glass. Ice clinked when I took it. The sound seemed to reach me from a distant world. There were several gates connecting that world with the place where I was, and I could hear the sound because they all just happened to be open at the moment. But this was strictly temporary. If even one of them closed, the sound would no longer reach my ears.
"Drink it," she said. "Lemon juice and water. It'll clear your head."
I managed to drink half and returned the glass to her. The cold water passed my throat and made its way down into my body, after which a violent wave of nausea overtook me. The decomposing lump of string in my stomach began to unravel and rise to the base of my throat. I closed my eyes and tried to let it pass. With my eyes closed, I saw Kumiko boarding the train with her blouse and skirt in hand. I thought it might be better to vomit, but I did not vomit. I took several deep breaths until the feeling diminished and disappeared altogether.
"Are you okay?"
asked Mei Kasahara. "Yes, I'm okay," I said.
"I made the call,"
she said.
"Told him I was a relative. That's okay, isn't it?"
"Uh-huh."
"This person, Kumiko Okada, that's Mrs. Windup Bird, isn't it?"
"Uh-huh."
"They said she didn't come to work. Today or yesterday. Just took off without a word. It's a real problem for them. She's not the type to do this kind of thing, they said."
"It's true. She's not the type."
"She's been gone since yesterday?"
I nodded.
"Poor Mr. Windup Bird,"
she said. She sounded as if she really did feel sorry for me. She put her hand on my forehead.
"Is there anything I can do?"
"Not now," I said, "but thanks."
"Do you mind if I ask more? Or would you rather I didn't?"
"Go ahead," I said. "I'm not sure I can answer, though."
"Did your wife run away with a man?"
"I'm not sure," I said. "Maybe. It's possible."
"But you've been living together all this time. How can you not be sure?"
She was right. How could I not be sure?
"Poor Mr. Windup Bird,"
she said again.
"I wish I had something to say to help you, but I don't know anything about married life."
I got out of my chair. The effort required to stand was far greater than I would have imagined. "Thanks for everything. You've been a big help. I've got to go now. I should be at home in case word comes. Somebody might call."
"As soon as you get home, take a shower, first thing, okay? Then put on clean clothes. And shave."
"Shave?" I stroked my jaw. It was true, I had forgotten to shave. The thought hadn't crossed my mind all morning.
"The little things are important, Mr. Windup Bird,"
Mei Kasahara said, looking into my eyes.
"Go home and take a good look in the mirror."
"I will," I said.
"Mind if I come over later?"
"Fine," I said. Then I added, "You'd be a great help." Mei Kasahara nodded in silence. At home, I looked at my face in the mirror. It was true. I looked terrible. I got undressed, showered, gave myself a good shampoo, shaved, brushed my teeth, put aftershave lotion on my face, and went to the mirror again for a close examination. A little better than before, it seemed. My nausea was gone. My head was still a little foggy, though. I put on short trousers and a fresh polo shirt. I sat on the veranda, leaning against a pillar and watching the garden while my hair dried. I tried to put the events of recent days in order. First, there was the call from Lieutenant Mamiya. That was yesterday morning? Yes, no doubt about it, yesterday morning. Then Kumiko had left the house. I had zipped up her dress. Then I had found the cologne box. Then Lieutenant Mamiya had come and told me his strange war stories, how he'd been captured by Outer Mongolian troops and thrown into a well. He had left me the keepsake for Mr. Honda, an empty box. Then Kumiko had failed to come home. She had picked up her cleaning that morning by the station and afterwards just disappeared, without a word to her company. So that was what had happened yesterday. I could hardly believe that all that had happened in the course of a single day. It was too much for one day. As I mulled these things over, I began to feel incredibly sleepy. This was not an ordinary kind of sleepiness. It was an intense, even violent sleepiness. Sleep was stripping me of consciousness the way the clothes might be stripped from the body of an unresisting person. I went to the bedroom without thinking, took everything off except my underwear, and got into bed. I tried to look at the clock on the night table, but I couldn't even turn my head. I closed my eyes and instantly fell into a deep, bottomless sleep. In my sleep, I was zipping up Kumiko's dress. I could see her smooth white back. But by the time I got the zip to the top, I realized it was not Kumiko, but Krita Kano. She and I were the only ones in the room. It was the same room as in the last dream, a room in the same hotel suite. On the table was a bottle of Cutty Sark and two glasses. There was also a stainless steel ice bucket full of ice. In the corridor outside, someone was passing by, speaking in a loud voice. I couldn't catch the words, which seemed to be in a foreign language. An unlit chandelier hung from the ceiling. The only illumination in this murky room came from lamps mounted on the wall. Again, the windows had thick curtains that were closed tight. Krita Kano was wearing a summer dress of Kumiko's, pale blue with an openwork pattern of birds. The skirt came up just above her knees. As always, her makeup was in the Jacqueline Kennedy style. On her left wrist, she wore a pair of matching bracelets. "How did you get that dress?" I asked. "Is it yours?" Krita Kano looked at me and shook her head. When she did this, the curled tips of her hair moved in a pleasant way. "No, it is not mine," she said. "I'm borrowing it. But don't worry, Mr. Okada. This is not causing anyone any difficulty." "Where are we?" I asked. Krita Kano didn't answer. As before, I was sitting on the edge of the bed. I wore a suit and my polka dot tie.
"You don't have to think about a thing, Mr. Okada," said Krita Kano. "There is nothing to worry about. Everything is going to be fine."
And again, as before, she unzipped my fly, took out my penis, and put it in her mouth. The one thing different from before was that she did not take off her own clothing. She wore Kumiko's dress the whole time. I tried to move, but it felt as if my body were tied down by invisible threads. I felt myself growing big and hard inside her mouth. I saw her fake eyelashes and curled hair tips moving. Her bracelets made a dry sound against each other. Her tongue was long and soft and seemed to wrap itself around me. Just as I was about to come, all of a sudden, she moved away and began slowly to undress me. She took off my jacket, my tie, my trousers, my shirt, my underwear, and made me lie down on the bed. She kept on her own clothes, though. She sat on the bed, took my hand, and brought it under her dress. She was not wearing panties. My hand felt the warmth of her vagina. It was deep, warm, and very wet. My fingers were all but sucked inside.
"Won't Noboru Wataya be here any minute?" I asked.
"Weren't you expecting him?" Instead of answering, Krita Kano touched my forehead.
"You don't have to think, Mr. Okada. We'll take care of all that. Leave everything to us."
"To us?" I asked. But there was no reply. Then Krita Kano mounted me and used her hand to slip me inside her. Once she had me deep inside, she began a slow rotation of her hips. As she moved, the edges of the pale blue dress caressed my naked stomach and thighs. With the skirts of the dress spread out around her, Krita Kano, riding me, looked like a soft, gigantic mushroom that had silently poked its face up through the dead leaves on the ground and opened under the sheltering wings of night. Her vagina felt warm and at the same time cold.
It tried to envelop me, to draw me in, and at the same time to force me out. My erection grew larger and harder. I felt I was about to burst wide open. It was the strangest sensation, something that went beyond simple sexual pleasure. It felt as if something inside her, something special inside her, were slowly working its way through my organ into me. With her eyes closed, and her chin lifted slightly, Greta Gano rocked quietly back and forth as if she were dreaming. I could see her chest rising and falling with each breath beneath the dress. A few hairs had come loose and hung over her forehead. I imagined myself floating alone in the middle of a vast sea. I closed my eyes and listened, expecting to hear the sound of little waves hitting my face. My body was bathed in lukewarm ocean water. I sensed the gradual flow of the tide. It was carrying me away. I decided to do as Greta Gano had said and not think about anything. I closed my eyes, let the strength go out of my limbs, and gave myself up to the current. All of a sudden, I noticed that the room had gone dark. I tried to look around, but I could hardly see a thing. The wall lamps had all been extinguished. There was only the faint silhouette of Greta Gano's blue dress rocking on top of me.
"Just forget," she said.
But it was not Greta Gano's voice.
"Forget about everything. You're asleep. You're dreaming. You're lying in nice, warm mud. We all come out of the warm mud, and we all go back to it."
It was the voice of the woman on the telephone. The mysterious woman on the phone had now mounted me and was joining her body with mine. She, too, wore Kumiko's dress. She and Greta Gano had traded places without my being aware of it. I tried to speak. I did not know what I hoped to say, but I at least tried to speak. I was too confused, though, and my voice would not work. All I could expel from my mouth was a hot blast of air. I opened my eyes wide and tried to see the face of the woman mounted on top of me, but the room was too dark. The woman said nothing more. Instead, she began to move her hips in an even more erotic way. Her soft flesh, itself almost an independent organism, enveloped my erection with a gentle pulling motion. From behind her I heard, or thought I heard, the sound of a knob turning. A white flash went through the darkness. The ice bucket on the table might have shone momentarily in the light from the corridor, or the flash might have been the glint of a sharp blade. But I couldn't think anymore. There was only one thing I could do. I came. I washed myself off in the shower and laundered my semen-stained underwear by hand. Terrific, I thought. Why did I have to be having wet dreams at such a difficult time in my life? Once again I put on fresh clothing, and once again I sat on the veranda looking at the garden. Splashes of sunlight danced on everything, filtered through thick green leaves. Several days of rain had promoted a powerful growth of bright green weeds here and there, giving the garden a subtle shading of ruin and stagnation. Greta Gano again. Two wet dreams in a short interval, and both times it had been Greta Gano. Never once had I thought of sleeping with her. The desire had not even entered my mind. And yet both times I'd been in that room, joining my body with hers. What could possibly be the reason for this? And who was that telephone woman who had taken her place? She knew me, and I supposedly knew her. I went through the various sexual partners I had had in my life, but none of them could be the telephone woman. Still, there was something about her that seemed familiar. And that was what annoyed me. Some kind of memory was trying to force its way out. I could feel it in there, bumping around. All I needed was a little hint. If I pulled that one tiny thread, then everything would unravel. The mystery was waiting for me to solve it, but the one slim thread was something I couldn't find. I gave up trying to think. "Forget everything. You're asleep.
You're dreaming. You're lying in nice, warm mud. We all come out of the warm mud, and we all go back to it.
6 o'clock came, and still no phone call. Only Mei Kasahara showed up. All she wanted, she said, was a sip of beer. I took a cold can from the refrigerator and split it with her. I was hungry, so I put some ham and lettuce between two slices of bread and ate that. When she saw me eating, Mei said she would like the same. I made her a sandwich, too. We ate in silence and drank our beer. I kept looking up at the wall clock.
Don't you have a TV in this house?
No TV, I said.
She gave the edge of her lip a little bite.
I thought so. Don't you like TV?
I don't dislike it. I get along fine without it. Mei Kasahara let that sink in for a while.
How many years have you been married, Mr. Wind-Up Bird?
6, I said.
And you've got by without TV for 6 years?
Uh-huh. At first we didn't have the money to buy one, then we got used to living without it. It's nice and quiet that way.
The two of you must have been happy.
What makes you think so? She wrinkled up her face.
Well, I couldn't live a day without television.
Because you're unhappy? Mei Kasahara did not reply to that.
But now Kumiko is gone. You must be not so happy anymore, Mr. Wind-Up Bird.
I nodded and sipped my beer. That's about the size of it, I said. That was about the size of it. She put a cigarette between her lips and with a practiced movement struck a match to light it.
Now, Mr. Wind-Up Bird,
she said,
I want you to tell me the absolute truth. Do you think I'm ugly?
I put my beer glass down and took another look at Mei Kasahara's face. All this time, while talking to her, I had been vaguely thinking of other things. She was wearing an oversized black tank top, which gave a clearer view of the girlish swell of her breasts. You're not the least bit ugly, I said. That's for sure. Why do you ask?
My boyfriend always used to tell me how ugly I was, that I didn't have any boobs.
The boy who wrecked the bike?
Yeah, him.
I watched Mei Kasahara slowly exhaling cigarette smoke. Boys that age will say things like that. They don't know how to express exactly what they feel, so they say and do the opposite. They hurt people that way for no reason at all, and they hurt themselves too. Anyhow, you're not the least bit ugly. I think you're very pretty. No flattery intended. Mei Kasahara mulled that one over for a while. She dropped ash into the empty beer can.
Is Mrs. Wind-Up Bird pretty?
That's hard for me to say. Some would say she is, and some would say not. It's a matter of taste.
I see,
she said. She tapped on her glass as if bored. What's your biker boyfriend doing? I asked. Doesn't he come to see you anymore?
No, he doesn't,
said Mei Kasahara, laying a finger on the scar by her left eye.
I'll never see him again, that's for sure. 200% sure. I'd bet my left little toe on it. But I'd rather not talk about that right now. Some things, you know, if you say them, it makes them not true. You know what I mean, Mr. Wind-Up Bird?
I think I do, I said. Then I glanced at the phone in the living room. It sat on the table, cloaked in silence. It looked like a deep-sea creature pretending to be an inanimate object, crouching there in wait for its prey.
Someday, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, I'll tell you all about him, when I feel like it, but not now. I just don't feel like it now.
She looked at her watch.
Gotta get home. Thanks for the beer.
I saw her out to the garden wall. A nearly full moon was pouring its grainy light down on the earth. The sight of the full moon reminded me that Kumiko's period was approaching. But that would probably have nothing to do with me anymore. The thought sent a sharp pain through my chest. The intensity of it caught me off guard. It resembled sorrow. With her hand on the wall, Mei Kasahara looked at me.
Tell me, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. You do love Kumiko, don't you?
I think I do.
Even though she might have gone off with a lover? If she said she wanted to come back to you, would you take her back?
I let out a sigh.
That's a tough question, I said. I'd have to think about it once it really happened.
Sorry for sticking my nose in,
said Mei Kasahara with a little click of her tongue.
But don't get angry. I'm just trying to learn. I want to know what it means for a wife to run away. There are all kinds of things I don't know.
I'm not angry, I said. Then I looked up at the full moon again.
All right then, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. You take care of yourself. I hope your wife comes back and everything works out.
Moving with incredible lightness, Mei Kasahara swung herself over the wall and disappeared into the summer night. With Mei Kasahara gone, I was alone again. I sat on the veranda, thinking about the questions she had raised. If Kumiko had gone off somewhere with a lover, could I take her back again? I didn't know the answer. I really didn't know. There were all kinds of things that I didn't know. Suddenly the phone rang. My hand shot out and picked up the receiver. The voice at the other end belonged to a woman.
This is Multicano, she said. Please forgive me for calling you so often, Mr. Okada, but I was wondering if you might happen to have any plans for tomorrow.
I had no plans, I said. Plans were simply something I did not have.
In that case, I wonder if it might be possible for me to see you in the afternoon.
Does this have something to do with Kumiko?
I believe that it does,
said Multicano, choosing her words carefully.
Noboru Wataya will also be joining us, most likely.
I almost dropped the receiver when I heard this. You mean the three of us will be getting together to talk?
Yes, I believe that is the case, said Multicano. The present situation makes this necessary. I am sorry, but I cannot go into any further detail on the telephone.
I see. All right, then, I said.
Shall we meet at 1 o'clock? In the same place we met before? The tea room of the Shinagawa Pacific Hotel?
1 o'clock in the tea room of the Shinagawa Pacific Hotel, I repeated, and hung up. Mei Kasahara called at 10 o'clock. She had nothing in particular to say. She just wanted to talk to somebody. We chatted about harmless topics for a while.
Tell me, Mr. Wind-Up Bird,
she said in the end.
Have you had any good news since I was there?
No good news, I said. Nothing.
3. Noboru Wataya Speaks. The Story of the Monkeys of the Shitty Island. I arrived at the tea room 10 minutes early, but Noboru Wataya and Multicano had already found a table and were waiting for me. The lunchtime crowd was thick, but I spotted Multicano immediately. Not too many people wore red vinyl hats on sunny summer afternoons. It must have been the same hat she had on the day I met her, unless she owned a collection of vinyl hats, all the same style and color. She dressed with the same tasteful simplicity as before, a short-sleeved linen jacket over a collarless cotton top. Both pieces were perfectly white and perfectly free of wrinkles. No accessories, no makeup. Only the red vinyl hat clashed with the rest of the outfit, both in tone and in material. As if she'd been waiting for my arrival to do so, she removed the hat when I took my seat, placing it on the table. Beside the hat lay a small yellow leather handbag. She had ordered some tonic water, but had not touched it, as before. The liquid seemed somehow uncomfortable in its tall glass, as if it had nothing better to do than produce its little bubbles. Noboru Wataya was wearing green sunglasses. As soon as I sat down, he removed them and stared at the lenses for a while, then he put them back on. He wore what looked like a brand new white polo shirt under a navy cotton sports jacket. There was a glass of iced tea on the table in front of him, but he too had apparently not touched his drink yet. I ordered a coffee and took a sip of ice water. No one spoke. Noboru Wataya appeared not even to have noticed that I had arrived. In order to make sure that I had not suddenly turned transparent, I put a hand on the table and watched it as I turned it over a few times. The waiter came, set a cup in front of me, and filled it with coffee. After he'd left, Multicano made little throat-clearing sounds as if testing a microphone. But still, she said nothing. The first to speak was Noboru Wataya.
I have very little time to spare, so let's make this as simple and straightforward as possible.
He seemed to be talking to the stainless steel sugar bowl in the middle of the table, but of course he was speaking to me. The sugar bowl was just a convenient midpoint between us towards which he could direct his speech. Make what as simple and straightforward as possible? I asked in a straightforward manner. At last Noboru Wataya took off his sunglasses, folded them, placed them on the table, and looked straight at me. More than 3 years had gone by since I had last met and spoken to the man, but I felt no sense of the intervening time, thanks, I assumed, to having had his face thrust in front of me so often by the media. Certain kinds of information are like smoke. They work their way into people's eyes and minds, whether sought out or not, and with no regard to personal preference. Forced now to see the man in person, I couldn't help but notice how much the 3 years had changed the impression his face made. That almost stagnant, muddy look of his had been pushed into the background, to be covered over by something slick and artificial. Noboru Wataya had managed to find for himself a new, more sophisticated mask. A very well-made mask, to be sure, perhaps even a new skin. Whatever it was, mask or skin, I had to admit, yes, even I had to admit, that it had a certain kind of attractive power. And then it hit me. Looking at this face was like looking at a television image. He talked the way people on television talked, and he moved the way people on television moved. There was always a layer of glass between us. I was on this side, and he was on that side.
As I am sure you must realize, we are here today to talk about Kumiko, said Noboru Wataya. About Kumiko and you. About your future. What you and she are going to do.
Going to do? I said, lifting my coffee cup and taking a sip. Could you be a little more specific?
Noboru Wataya looked at me with strangely expressionless eyes.
A little more specific. Kumiko has taken a lover. She's left you. Surely you are not suggesting that anyone involved in the present situation wants it to continue forever. That would not be good for anyone.
Taken a lover? I asked. Now, please, just wait a moment. Multicano chose at this point to intervene. A discussion such as this has its own proper order. Mr. Wataya? Mr. Okada? It is important to proceed in an orderly fashion.
I don't see that, said Noboru Wataya, without any sense of life in his voice. There is no order to this. What kind of order do you mean? This discussion doesn't have any.
Let him speak first, I said to Multicano. We can impose the proper order afterwards, assuming there is one.
Multicano looked at me for a few seconds with her lips lightly pursed, then gave a little nod.
All right, then, she said. Mr. Wataya first, please.
Kumiko has another man in her life, he began. And now she's gone off with him. This much is clear. Which means there would be no point in your continuing to stay married. Fortunately, there are no children involved, and in view of the circumstances, no money need change hands. Everything can be settled quickly. She simply pulls out of your family register. You just have to sign and put your seal on forms prepared by a lawyer, and that takes care of that. And let me add this to avoid any misunderstanding. What I am saying now is the final view of the entire Wataya family.
I folded my arms and mulled over his words for a time. I have a few questions, I said. First of all, how do you know that Kumiko has another man?
She told me so herself, said Noboru Wataya.
I did not know what to say to that. I put my hands on the table and remained silent. It was hard for me to imagine Kumiko going to Noboru Wataya with such a personal matter.
She called me a week ago, and said she had something to discuss, continued Noboru Wataya. We met and talked, face to face. That's when Kumiko told me she was seeing someone else.
For the first time in months, I felt like a smoke. Of course, I had no cigarettes with me. Instead, I took a sip of coffee and put the cup back in the saucer with a loud, dry clash.
Then she left home, he said.
I see, I said. If you say so, it must be true. Kumiko must have had a lover. And she went to you for advice. It's hard for me to believe, but I can't imagine you're lying to me about such a thing.
No, of course I'm not lying, said Noboru Wataya, with the hint of a smile on his lips.
So is that all you have to tell me?
Kumiko left me for another man, so I should agree to a divorce? Noboru Wataya responded with a single, small nod, as if he were trying to conserve energy.
I suppose you realize that I was not in favor of Kumiko marrying you to begin with. I took no positive steps to interfere, on the assumption that it was a matter that did not concern me, but now I almost wish I had.
He took a sip of water and set his glass on the table again. Then he continued.
From the first day I met you, I knew better than to hope you might amount to anything. I saw no sign of promise, nothing in you that suggested you might accomplish something worthwhile, or even turn yourself into a respectable human being, nothing there to shine or to shed light on anything. I knew that whatever you set your hand to would end up half-baked, that you would never see anything through to the end. And I was right. You have been married to my sister for 6 years, and what have you done in all that time? Nothing, right? All you've accomplished in 6 long years is to leave your job and ruin Kumiko's life. Now you're out of work, and you have no plans for the future. There's nothing inside that head of yours but garbage and rocks. Why Kumiko ever got together with the likes of you, I'll never understand. Maybe she thought the garbage and rocks in your head were interesting. But finally, garbage is garbage, and rocks are rocks. You were wrong for her from the start. Which is not to say that Kumiko was perfection either. She had her own oddities since childhood for one reason or another. I suppose that's why she was briefly attracted to you. But that's all over now. In any case, the best thing will be to finish this business as quickly as possible. My parents and I will watch out for Kumiko. We want you to back off, and don't try to find her. You got nothing to do with her anymore. All you can do is cause trouble if you try to get involved. The best thing you can do is to begin a new life in a new place, a life that is better suited to you. That would be best for you and best for us.
To signal that he was finished, Noboru Wataya drained the water in his glass, called the waiter, and ordered more.
Do you have anything else to say? I asked.
Noboru Wataya responded this time with a single small shake of the head.
In that case, I said to Multicano, what is the proper order for this discussion?
Multicano took a small white handkerchief from her bag and used it to wipe the corners of her mouth. Then she picked up her red vinyl hat from the table and set it on top of the bag.
I'm certain this is all very shocking to you, Mr. Okada, she said, and for my part, I find it extremely painful to be speaking about such things with you face to face, as you can imagine.
Noboru Wataya glanced at his watch in order to ascertain that the world was still spinning on its axis and costing him precious time.
I see now, Multicano continued, that I must make this as simple and straightforward as possible. Mrs. Okada came to see me first. She came to me for advice.
On my recommendation, interjected Noboru Wataya. Kumiko came to talk to me about the cat, and I introduced her to Miss Kano.
Was that before I met you or after? I asked Multicano.
Before, she said.
In that case, I said, to put things in their proper order, it went something like this.
Kumiko learned about your existence from Noboru Wataya, and she went to see you about the lost cat. Then, for some reason that is still not clear to me, she hid from me the fact that she had already met you and arranged for me to see you, which I did, in this very place. Am I right?
That is approximately correct, said Multicano with some difficulty. My first discussion with Mrs. Okada was strictly about the cat. I could tell there was something more to it than that, however, which is why I wanted to meet you and speak to you direct. Then it became necessary for me to meet Mrs. Okada one more time and to ask her about deeper, personal matters.
Which is when Kumiko told you she had a lover?
Yes. In short, I believe that is the case. Given my position, it is not possible for me to go into any greater detail than that, said Multicano.
I let out a sigh. Not that sighing was going to accomplish anything, but it was something I had to do. So then, Kumiko had been involved with this man for some time?
2.5 months or thereabouts, I believe.
2.5 months, I said.
How could it have been going on for 2.5 months without my noticing anything? Because, Mr. Okada, you had no doubts whatsoever about your wife, said Multicano.
I nodded. That's true. It never once crossed my mind. I never imagined Kumiko could lie to me like that, and I still can't really believe it.
Results aside, the ability to have complete faith in another human being is one of the finest qualities a person can possess.
Not an easy ability to come by, said Noboru Wataya.
The waiter approached and refilled my coffee cup. A young woman at the next table was laughing out loud.
So then, I said to Noboru Wataya, what is the ultimate purpose of this gathering? Why are the three of us together here? To get me to agree to divorce Kumiko? Or is there some deeper objective? There did seem to be a kind of logic to what you said earlier, but all the important parts are vague. You say Kumiko has a man and has left the house. So where did she go? What is she doing there? Is she by herself or is she with him? Why hasn't Kumiko got in touch with me? If it's true she has another man, that's the end of that. But I won't believe it's true until I hear it directly from her. Do you understand? The only ones who count here are Kumiko and me. We're the ones who have to talk to each other and decide things. You've got nothing to do with this.
Noboru Wataya pushed his untouched glass of iced tea aside.
We are here to inform you of the situation, he said. I asked Miss Kano to accompany me, thinking it would be better to have a third party present. I don't know who Kumiko's other man is, and I don't know where she is now. Kumiko is grown up. She can do as she pleases. But even if I knew where she was, I certainly wouldn't tell you. She hasn't been in touch with you because she doesn't want to talk to you.
She did want to talk to you, apparently. How much could she have told you? You and she are not very close, as I understand it.
Well, if you and she were so damn close, why did she sleep with another man?
Said Noboru Wataya. Multicano gave a little cough. Noboru Wataya went on.
Kumiko told me she's having a relationship with another man. She said she wants to settle everything once and for all. I advised her to divorce you. She said she would think about it.
Is that all?
I asked.
What else is there?
I just don't get it, I said. I don't believe that Kumiko would go to you with something so important. You're the last person she would consult on such a matter. She would either think it out for herself or speak to me. She must have said something else to you. If she had to talk to you in person, it must have been about something else.
Noboru Wataya allowed the faintest possible smile to play over his lips. A thin, cold smile, like a sliver of a moon hovering in the dawn sky.
This is what they mean by letting the truth slip out,
he said in a soft but clearly audible voice.
Letting the truth slip out, I said, testing the expression for myself. I'm sure you see my point, he said. Your wife sleeps with another man. She runs out on you, and then you try to pin the blame on someone else. I've never heard of anything so stupid. Look, I didn't come here for my own pleasure. It was something I had to do. For me, it's just a waste of time. I might as well be throwing my time into the gutter.
When he had finished speaking, a deep silence settled over the table. Do you know the story of the monkeys of the Shitty Island? I asked Noboru Wataya. He shook his head with no sign of interest. Never heard of it. Somewhere far, far away, there's a shitty island. An island without a name. An island not worth giving a name. A shitty island with a shitty shape. On this shitty island grow palm trees that also have shitty shapes. And the palm trees produce coconuts that give off a shitty smell. Shitty monkeys live in the trees, and they love to eat these shitty-smelling coconuts, after which they shit the world's foulest shit. The shit falls on the ground and builds up shitty mounds, making the shitty palm trees that grow on them even shittier. It's an endless cycle. I drank the rest of my coffee. As I sat here, looking at you, I continued, I suddenly remembered the story of this shitty island. What I'm trying to say is this. A certain kind of shittiness, a certain kind of stagnation, a certain kind of darkness goes on propagating itself by its own power in its own self-contained cycle. And once it passes a certain point, no one can stop it, even if the person himself wants to stop it. Noboru Wataya's face wore no expression of any kind. The smile was gone, but neither was there any shadow of annoyance. All I could see was one small wrinkle between his eyebrows, and I could not recall if it was something that had been there before. "Are you catching my drift, Mr. Wataya?" I went on. "I know exactly the sort of man you are. You say I'm like garbage or rocks, and you think you could smash me to bits any time you felt like it, but things are not that simple. To you, with your values, I may well be nothing but garbage and rocks, but I'm not as stupid as you think I am. I know exactly what you've got under that smooth, made-for-TV mask of yours. I know your secret. Kumiko knows, and I know. We both know what's under there. If I wanted to, I could tell it to the world. I could bring it out into the light. It might take time, but I could do it. I may be a nobody, but at least I'm not a sandbag. I'm a living, breathing human being. If somebody hits me, I hit back. Make sure you keep that in mind." Noboru Wataya went on staring at me with that expressionless face of his, a face like a chunk of rock floating in space. What I had said to him was almost pure bluff. I did not know Noboru Wataya's secret. That he had something profoundly warped inside him was not difficult to conceive, but I had no way of knowing with any certainty what that might be. My words, though, seemed to have jabbed at something in there. I could read the effect on his face. He didn't respond to me the way he always did to his opponents in televised panel discussions. He didn't sneer at my words or try to trip me up or find some clever opening. He sat there in silence without moving a muscle. Then something very odd began to happen to Noboru Wataya's face. Little by little it started to turn red. But it did this in the strangest way. Certain patches turned a deep red, while others reddened only slightly, and the rest appeared to have become weirdly pale. This made me think of an autumn wood with blotchy colors, where deciduous and evergreen trees grow in a chaotic mix. Eventually, without a word, Noboru Wataya stood up, took his sunglasses from his pocket, and put them on. The strange, blotchy colors still covered his face. They looked almost permanent now. Multicano remained perfectly still in her seat, saying nothing. I myself adopted an expression of complete indifference. Noboru Wataya began to say something to me, but in the end seemed to have decided against it. Instead, he walked away from the table and disappeared into the crowd. For a while after Noboru Wataya left, Multicano and I said nothing to each other. I felt exhausted. The waiter came and offered to refill my coffee cup, but I sent him away. Multicano picked up a red hat from the table and stared at it for a few minutes before setting it down on the chair next to her. I sensed a bitter taste in my mouth. I tried to wash it away by drinking some water, but this did no good. After another short interval, Multicano spoke.
"Feelings need to be let out sometimes. Otherwise the flow can stagnate inside. I'm sure you feel better now that you have said what you wanted to say."
"A little," I said. "But it didn't solve anything. It didn't bring anything to a conclusion."
"You don't like Mr. Wataya, do you, Mr. Okada?"
Every time I talk to that guy, I get this feeling of incredible emptiness inside. Every single object in the room begins to look as if it has no substance to it. Everything appears hollow. Exactly why this should be, I could never explain to you with any precision. Because of this feeling, I end up saying and doing things that are simply not me, and I feel terrible about it afterwards. If I could manage never to see him again, nothing would make me happier. Multicano shook her head.
Unfortunately, you will be required to encounter Mr. Wataya any number of times again. This is something you will not be able to avoid.
She could well be right. I couldn't get him out of my life so easily. I picked up my glass and took another drink of water.
Where had that awful taste come from?
There's just one thing I would like to ask you, I said. Whose side are you on here? Noboru Wataya's or mine? Multicano put her elbows on the table and brought her palms together before her face.
Neither,
she said.
There are no sides in this case. They simply do not exist. This is not the kind of thing that has a top and bottom, a right and left, a front and back, Mr. Okada.
Sounds like Zen, I said. Interesting enough in itself as a system of thought, but not much good for explaining anything. She nodded her head. The palms that she was pressing together in front of her face, she now pulled 3 inches apart, holding them at a slight angle and aiming them towards me. They were small, well-shaped palms.
I know that what I am saying does not seem to make a great deal of sense, and I don't blame you for being angry, but if I were to tell you anything now, it would serve no practical purpose. In fact, it would ruin things. You will have to win through your own strength, with your own hands.
Like in Wild Kingdom, I said with a smile. You get hit, you hit back.
That's it, said Multicano. Exactly.
Then with all the care of someone retrieving the belongings of a person newly dead, she picked up her handbag and put on her red vinyl hat. When she set the hat on her head, Multicano conveyed a strange yet tangible impression that a unit of time had now come to an end. After Multicano had left, I went on sitting there alone, with nothing particular on my mind. I had no idea where I should go or what I should do if I were to stand up. But of course, I couldn't stay there forever. When 20 minutes had passed like this, I paid for the three of us and left the tea room. Neither of the other two had paid.
4. Divine Grace Lost, Prostitute of the Mind. At home, I found a thick letter waiting. It was from Lieutenant Mamiya. My name and address had been written on the envelope in the same bold, handsome characters as before. I changed my clothes, washed my face, and went to the kitchen, where I drank 2 glasses of cold water. Once I had had a moment to catch my breath, I cut the letter open. Lieutenant Mamiya had used a fountain pen to fill some 10 thin sheets of paper with tiny characters. I flipped through the pages and put them back into the envelope. I was too tired to read such a long letter. I didn't have the powers of concentration just then. When my eyes scanned the rows of handwritten characters, they looked like a swarm of strange blue bugs. And besides, the voice of Noboru Wataya was still echoing faintly in my mind. I stretched out on the sofa and closed my eyes for a long time, thinking of nothing. It was not hard for me to think of nothing, the way I felt at the moment. In order not to think of any one thing, all I had to do was think of many things, a little at a time, just think about something for a moment and fling it into space. It was nearly 5 o'clock in the evening when I finally decided to read Lieutenant Mamiya's letter. I went out to the veranda, sat leaning against a pillar, and took the pages from the envelope. The whole of the first page was filled with conventional phrases, extended seasonal greetings, thanks for my having invited him to my home the other day, and profound apologies for having bored me with his endless stories. Lieutenant Mamiya was certainly a man who knew the civilities. He was a survivor of an age when such civilities occupied a major portion of daily life. I skimmed through those.
and turned to the second page.
Please forgive me for having gone on at such length with these preliminary matters. My sole purpose in writing this letter today, knowing full well that my presumptuousness in doing so can only burden you with an